Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, clinicians, founders, politicians that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc is helping healthcare systems all over the world find, screen, diagnose, and ultimately treat significantly larger volumes of people to aid in the prevention of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and chronic kidney disease. Our first and flagship product, the Healthy Heart Check, delivers the equivalent of the NHS Health Check in just 8 minutes, and it's the number one diagnostic test on the high street, apart from COVID and pregnancy, which are quite big categories. So you can go to any of the major high street retailers or Amazon or our own website, which is pocdoc.co. So that's P-O-C-D-O-C.co. And thank you to PocDoc, as ever, for supporting the show. Thank you also to everyone watching, listening, downloading. Thank you very much, as always, to UK Health Radio for the live platform. So across all of these platforms, we get about 300,000 streams a month now, which is incredible. And we have listeners downloading the show in over 50 countries every single month, which is just mind-blowing. So thank you so, so much for following. If you can take the time to leave a review, leave a comment, it all helps grow the show. So thank you so much. On to today's show, though, we have our first repeat Health Tech Hour guest, which gives me huge, huge pleasure to introduce James Bethel, who is a former health minister. He was one of the leading health ministers during COVID. He is a member of the House of Lords. He is a progressive health advocate and has had a long career in building extremely successful businesses. James, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm really touched to be back and welled up slightly when you said that.
Yes. But it is great to have you back. And since you came on, I think it's fair to say that your passion for health advocacy has really accelerated, I think.
It has. And the thing that has really driven it is the science. I think that the incredible breakthroughs we're seeing in terms of early stage detection, like PocDoc, and early stage treatment is remarkable. That said, health systems are really creaking and struggling to keep up with the change and actually to keep up with the huge stock of ill people that there are out there. So it's been a pretty frustrating couple of years, I've got to admit.
Yeah, I think obviously you and I know each other quite well, and I consider you to be a friend, which is
Thank you.
I feel hugely honored to be able to say that. And I know that you're a bit conflicted, I think it's fair to say, in this space, because you're so passionate about change. But I think also you, having worked on the inside as a health minister, you've also seen how creaky the ship is.
Is that right? Yeah, the ship is creaking. I don't think that's a big revelation to anyone. I think the thing I would try to get across is that a lot of the problems we face are essentially political rather than structural or financial. In other words, we know how to make this country healthier. We have the techniques and the insight and the science to be able to treat disease earlier, to head off on people's behaviours. But the politics of it are really challenging. And I've been a minister. Mm. I've fought elections. I know how difficult it is to step into the public and to say, we need you to change the way in which you lead your life, to step into doctors and say, we need you now to learn new crafts, new skills, to go to health administrators and to say, we need to incentivize you on a different set of targets. Those are all really difficult things to do. But I am frustrated that even though we've got a government with a huge majority,
a massive majority,
and with a manifesto commitment to doing these things, somehow that stuff isn't happening.
Yeah.
And it's not just in the UK. It's not like we're uniquely bad in class, but across the piece, we're really struggling. And it's mainly because the message hasn't got across to the public that we need to do something about this. Otherwise, our country is frankly going to be bust. We're going to be spending all of taxpayers' money on the NHS and nothing else.
So let's pick that up. There's a few things in there. So how would you define, just so, because we're a broad church, but how would you define this concept of like a political problem versus like a cash problem or a structure problem?
So all systems should be in a state of dynamic reform all of the time, whether you're running the defense budget or the education budget, as new insights and new techniques come through.
A bit like painting the fourth bridge,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
When you get to the end of it and then you've got to start repainting the beginning bit.
And that is particularly, and health is at a particular inflection point because of three reasons. The demographic change, which is we have more older people than younger people than ever before. The rise in chronic disease over injury and contagious disease. That means that the model of care has got to change. Mm. And then thirdly is the huge breakthroughs that we're seeing in terms of the technologies around data, around vaccines, around early stage care, about behavioral change. Mm. All of these things are new tools that were foolish not to pick up.
Yeah.
So those are the three big drivers of change. It's political because the problems we're having are persuading the producer interest, the doctors, the hospitals, the people who actually deliver care, that they need to change the way in which they do their work.
Mm.
And to persuade the patients that they need to look after their health in different ways and, frankly, to eat and take exercise and to report earlier to the doctor. And we need to challenge industry, many of which are profiteering out of the fact that they're selling goods that are bad for us but not charging us the external costs.
Okay, so there's this thing, I can't remember which book it was in, but I've read one or two over the years that talk about this concept of externalities.
Yes.
So the true cost when you bake in all the externalities, which I don't believe is happening in food.
No, it isn't.
So, and I know that you're big on ultra-processed food, as in against it. And I know that we both have the Vantoulikans in common,
yes.
I believe. You know, so... where do you stand on, we're jumping around a bit, I guess, but where do you stand on this idea that health policy and food policy should be somewhat combined or at least a continuum of the same?
Yeah, well, I think we can make Britain a healthier country, but there's not a single shot to doing that. It's not like, oh, if only we solved primary care or had more health visitors.
Yeah.
There's not one thing that's going to do that. I take a kitchen sink approach. It's got to be everything.
Yep.
We have to deploy the new technologies that are available to us. We have to pivot our health system. And we have to tackle the polluting industries. And those polluting industries include junk food industry, gambling industry, the internet filth industry, the dirty air industry, the moldy home industry.
Mm.
All of these, broadly called the determinants of health, are profiting because they don't pay for the health consequences of their industry. And food is a really good example. Now, the idea of externalities is not new. The Victorians understood it. They understood that, yeah, sure, sending kids down mines meant that they didn't get an education and died early and couldn't work because they had so much soot in their lungs. That's why we stopped sending kids down mines.
Wow. Because it was affecting the long-term workforce provision.
Absolutely. It was an economic decision.
Wow. I didn't know that.
With a top spin of moral justice and biblical belief.
Right.
But really, it was an economic decision.
Wow.
Likewise, stuffing our children full of fried chicken is the equivalent. And we are ending up with kids who simply can't make the decisions necessary to lead a healthy life.
Mm.
If you've got a BMI of 30 when you're 12, the chances of you dying with a BMI under 30 are tiny.
Is that right?
You are set for life on a course that's going to be unhealthy. And that is a crazy way to run a country.
Mm.
Now, do I blame hardworking fried chicken entrepreneurs in Britain? I'd like not to. I don't take a moral point of view. It's a economic and pragmatic point of view. We just can't run a country where the air is so dirty, where the food is so poor, where our internet experiences are so full of filth and fraud and algorithms that muck with our heads, that we end up with a population that costs a fortune to treat.
Mm.
And that is going to break the finances of the country, either in our lifetime, Steve, but certainly in our children's lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, I think when we put it like that, it does sound It's the thing that gets me, and one of the reasons why I am so passionate about what we do at PocDoc and why I'm so passionate about supporting the industry and things like that, the wider health industry, is that there are, to your point, dealing with health specifically, not some of those other determinants, is there are so many solutions out there.
There are now.
So many, and they're coming out every day, and it doesn't have to be a vaccine or a drug. It can be a diagnostic or a therapeutic, or it could be all kinds of different things. What, in your experience as a health minister, what is the key determinant of stuff that gets into the front line and stuff that doesn't?
Yeah,
well, what? Because you must have seen a spread of stuff in your career.
I don't know if I have a great answer for that. What I admire about the British system and the way in which we do things in the UK is that we are very empirical. It is science led. Decisions made by the Royal Colleges, by NICE, by MHRA, by the key regulators and determinants of medical practice are very much led by science. And as a result, from a clinical point of view, we don't make the big mistakes that some other countries have made over putting the wrong treatments to the front line. And of that, we should be grateful and enormously proud. Mm-hmm. Where we have become very arthritic and where there is now basically an adoption paralysis is that we've become so risk adverse and we have become so concerned about troubling our workforce with change that we're basically saying no to any kind of innovation whatsoever. Mm. And I am worried that we run a ton of pilots in the UK and we've become the science lab rats for the world.
We are.
We are absolute pioneers on latest practice, but we don't pick it up and actually deliver it to our population. And many of the practices that patients will see when they go to their doctors have been overtaken in other countries many years ago.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one. So we see that obviously from PocDoc's perspective, and we've been, you know, we're really grateful and really humbled, but we've been really successful about scaling through the NHS, which is amazing, and solely down to the NHS. Really, and individuals in the NHS adopting us. But one of the things that I noticed is that, to your point around pilots, so everyone listening, a pilot sort of, some people call it a phase one, but it's sort of like your first swing of the bat, you know? Yeah. It's a small number of people, reasonably small contract size, doesn't need to go out to any kind of tender or procurement process. Locally, they can kind of make a decision on it. The money comes out of that year's budget, suck it and see. You know, let's have a punt. And a lot of the time, those pilots turn out really positively.
Yeah,
for everyone, they do. And I think the challenge really is how to take that pilot into a phase two or a phase three. And where the NHS is good is that they're good at procuring stuff, right?
Yes.
Like they're really good at, they buy something like, I did the research the other day. I think that they buy something in the region of 8 billion separate pieces of medical equipment a year. Right?
Yeah.
There's a lot that you're procuring, but there seems to be this gap between things kind of labeled innovative and this enormous behemoth that procures 8 billion bits of medical tech every single year.
And, you know, if you strike lucky with the NHS and you can get through somehow, then there's a fantastic business for you there. And I am proud of the fact that the NHS does a good deal broadly for taxpayers.
Yep.
And, the price at which we buy basic supplies, medicines, is a really good one. And we should be grateful for that. Mm-hmm. Where we have got unstuck, though, is where do we hope for decision-making to happen? Where is devolution and where is central control in this? I actually don't really know the answer to this, because once something has broken through and demonstrated efficacy and safety, it should be broadly adopted across the platform. On the other hand, you can't run a £220 billion healthcare system from committees and ministerial fiat.
You can't run it central.
From the centre.
You can't.
You've got to give people control on the front line. And we've learned this from education. Mm-hmm. We've seen a revolution in education by giving headmasters control of how they do the teaching and who they employ, broadly speaking. And we judge them on their outcomes, on exam results.
Yep.
And we have a baseline of safety and performance, but really we let them crack on. We seem to be in turmoil about how we get that formula right in the UK. And as a result, there is this paralysis that no one knows who is really making decisions on things. So a lot of innovation gets repeated time and again. I remember going to about 100 emergency departments in the election in 2009.
Okay.
And every single one of them showed me a homegrown patient flow management system.
Is that right?
And it was heartbreaking. I couldn't help wondering that surely there must be a standard way of doing this.
Yeah. It's a really interesting concept. So, you know, I come from a background that wasn't in healthcare. And the idea of having to go to, you know, there are 42 regions, right?
Yeah.
So the idea of having to go to 42 regions to talk to them about your solution and do it 42 times isn't particularly concerning. But on the flip side, from an efficiency perspective, what's often happening is that, like you say, people are kind of cooking up a, you know, homebrew version of these things to solve an issue.
What people often say is that the top 25% are eager, the middle are sluggish, and the bottom 25% are impossible to deal with. But also within that, if you sell to X, Y will never buy it. So there is politics and complexity even within the system.
And funding restrictions.
And funding restrictions. And trying to get a sell into all 42 is virtually impossible.
Yeah. So we are going to stop for our first break right now. And thank you very much to my guest, James Bethel, advocate for health, former health minister. We will be back in 2 minutes with the next part of this week's Health Tech Hour.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, James Bethel. James, let's jump into a few specifics. So I know there's a few areas where you feel really passionately about. So one of them, for example, is one of the most important topics that comes up in the news. It rarely do we see a week where there isn't something about this in the news, which is weight loss.
Yes.
GLP-1s, weight loss drugs, injectables, etc. Where do you sort of stand on this? Because they are a miracle drug in some ways, in many ways, in fact.
They are. And I have been blown away by the impact it's had in two ways in particular. One is clearly they are working very well for a lot of people. Mm. And clearly they're going to get better. In other words, a wider variety of compounds taken in different ways.
Like pills.
Maybe even by aerosol sometime soon.
Mm-hmm.
And paired with other drugs so that if you have an existing condition, the pairing of the GLP-1 with treatment for the condition is going to get better. So I'm incredibly optimistic for the sector in the round. What is unresolved, though, is does this let us completely off the hook when it comes to dealing with the environment in which people are living in?
Yeah.
An environment in which half the country is doing almost no exercise, not meeting even the CMO's basic standard, which is 45 minutes of walking a week.
Wow. Half the country is not meeting that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Where half the country is overweight and struggling to manage a healthy lifestyle, where a third of our children have got weight issues that will affect them for the rest of their life. Does this mean that from a population point of view, we are all going to be taking these pretty much for a long time?
Yeah.
I take statins. Doesn't have any impact on me. Absolutely fine. Thank God every morning I take my statin.
Right.
Maybe that's the future. Maybe these GLP-1s will be like statins. But there is no clinical evidence that that is either a good thing or a wise thing.
No. Yeah, it strikes me that it's, I mean, look, it's helping people, which is wonderful. And there's all kinds of evidence out there that it helps with cardiovascular disease prevention, with type 2 diabetes prevention. I think that there's some emerging data, strong data around Alzheimer's and prevention, although, again, that's not my area. So,
and we're drinking. And we're gambling.
Yeah, exactly. So I know from a family member who took it, their craving for alcohol completely stopped.
Yeah,
I mean, so anecdotally,
so maybe I it know is. That's it, true. Maybe it is an antidote for our Neanderthal bodies to respond to the pressures of the 21st century.
But if those pressures don't, yeah. Sorry, go on.
Is that a format for healthy, fulfilling life in the future? That's not clear. That's not proven yet. So we have to step carefully.
And let's talk about, like, taking this particular issue. Where do you think the role of government is versus the role of the NHS, just around this issue?
Yeah. Well,
like, what do you think?
We don't know the answer to this. The thing that I am worried about is the inequality side of things. So we have 2.5 million people taking these drugs in the UK.
Privately, pretty much.
Almost all privately at the moment. The socioeconomic spread of those people is broader than you would think, but they are definitely aspirational people.
Well, they can afford 200 quid plus per month.
They can definitely afford 200 quid. And they are probably people who are on this self-improvement curve already.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we have half the country who are 4.5 million people who are off work because they're sick, who definitely can't afford it. So are they just going to be allowed to get sicker?
Mm.
Are they not going to have any access to these drugs?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think the NHS steps in. It's got to find a way to spread the benefits of this remarkable breakthrough so that all of the country can prosper and it isn't just the aspirational classes that are the ones. Because that's morally unjustifiable, but it's also economically unjustifiable. We can't have a country where half of our country is fit, prosperous and working and contributing, and half the country is essentially left behind with poor health and the consequential impact on their productivity, their wealth and their emotional prosperity.
Yeah, that's a bleak picture if we end up in that place. So how do we sort of avoid ending up in that place?
Well, I want the NHS to get stuck in, and it's going to have to do a resource shift. The credit card is maxed out. There's no more budget.
Yeah, there's no more money.
It's going to need to make some tough decisions. And I said at the beginning that a lot of this is politics. This would be a classic example.
Right.
Tough decisions are going to be need to made about stopping doing some things. Half the NHS budget is workforce. So if you say stop doing some things, you also mean stop employing some people.
Yes.
And shifting that budget to other things that are more productive for the nation's health, like the GLP-1s. I don't hear that debate being discussed in public. It needs to be much higher up the agenda. It's a really awkward, difficult. There'll be winners and losers. There'll be some people with good jobs on the way to good pensions who find that they have a diversion in their career. And there are going to be some people who thought that they had been doing a great job who find that their budgets are taken away from them. Well, that's what we need in our health system. We need more dynamism.
And who grasps that nettle? Because that is a very stingy nettle to grasp.
I know. Well, ultimately, it's political.
Right.
And, you know, I think that Wes Streeting was right to get rid of NHS England, the bureaucratic bit that stood between politicians and these kinds of decisions.
Mm.
And but he has therefore plonked decisions like this on his own desk.
Yeah. And I think that I think knowing what I know about the healthcare system, that type of decision there is a huge strategic shift.
It is.
It's basically, if you're a company, it's sort of saying what we've been making so far was great and is good, but the world has shifted.
So the most classic example in British history is that after the Cold War, we found that we had regiments of tanks in eastern Germany,
yep.
On the Rhine. We had a British army on the Rhine. We didn't need it anymore because the Russians had stood down. Mm-hmm. So we needed to bring back that army. And rather than having loads of tanks, we needed essentially an army of special forces,
right,
that were available to travel the world and deal with conflagrations, mm-hmm, as they came up. For the army, that was an incredibly painful reconfiguration. We had to get rid of regiments, which were much loved.
Mm.
Communities were broken up.
Did they actually get rid of the regiments?
They basically got rid of regiments.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Rid of a lot of generals. It was painful and bloody, and there are still scars today, mm-hmm, from people who are hurt during that process. But that's what modernization looks like. We need the equivalent in health.
Do you think it's easier for the military to do things like that?
No, I can tell you. having a lot of friends and close colleagues, it tore up their entire way of doing things and we may well need to pivot back again. If we genuinely engaged in the Ukraine, which has got to be a possibility, we're going to have to suddenly tool up with many of the skills, people and kit that we had in the old days.
Wow.
So these things are dynamic. You know, change is inevitable, but it has been right for the last 30 years for sure.
I mean, that is a really interesting, there's a really interesting insight around how to change complex organizations,
yes,
highly embedded complex organizations, and I agree with you. I don't hear people having an honest discussion about the concept of how complex and difficult this is, but we need to grasp the nettle. I feel like the debate has sort of stopped at, well, you know, we've got rid of bureaucracy now, so we should be fine.
I agree.
I
think that the debate is completely off the pace.
Yeah.
And we have a debate about virtual wards as though that was somehow going to fix things.
Yeah.
And they may be a good idea.
I'm sure
it
seems to be going well.
Tiny, moment compared to the kind of changes that we need.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about massive strategies that impact tens of millions of people.
Yes.
Not necessarily, you know, tinkering around the edges.
And an aspect of it is an ending of the idea that the British public can subcontract their health to the NHS.
Mm.
The idea that you can lead any kind of life you like, eat what you like, drink what you like, have whatever mental health you like, and then just turn up in your GP surgery or at A&E with a problem and expect the NHS to look after you. That is not a reasonable way of running a nation anymore, because we have this demographic bubble, we have this chronic disease tsunami. Mm. We need our own people to take more responsibility for their underlying health. We can't expect the NHS to pick up all of that burden.
How do you do that? That's really hard.
I think politicians have to look the camera in the eye,
mm,
and spell it out. There was one moment when that happened, of
yeah,
all people.
Yeah, who was it?
Boris Johnson.
Was it Bojo?
Did it after, when he recovered from COVID,
yeah,
he looked down the camera and said, I was 5 stone 2 heavy. When I went to A&E, my body was in no condition to fight this virus and I nearly died.
Mm.
We as a nation have eaten too many donuts. We need to change and shape up. And it was really powerful for about 8 months.
Yeah.
And then because he's the kind of guy he is, he got distracted and changed his mind. It was heartbreaking for me, because that was the kind of political leadership that we need. We're seeing it a bit weirdly in America. It's quite complicated.
It's a bit twisted, but I see where you're going.
Twisted.
You're seeing where, and carry on, because I know where you're going.
There are some themes in the Maha movement, in at the end chronic disease movement, about attributing fault to big country companies, the junk food companies.
Yeah,
they're bringing in European style food regulations that we've had for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's good to see them catching up on that. It won't be enough to turn around health in America, but it's being done by Trump in the White House because he thinks it's going to win him the next election.
Yeah.
In other words, health policy in America, whether you like it or not, has the benefit of being led from the top guy in the top place.
Mm.
And he's taking in all of government, the trade policy, mm-hmm. the industrial policy, the health department, the environment department. It's being done in a kitchen sink kind of way.
Yeah.
And that's what we need in the UK. And I'm heartbroken that Keir Starmer shows no interest in health whatsoever. He doesn't model good behaviour. He doesn't speak about health. Yeah. He's leaving it to others to pick up the pieces. Well,
so I'm a huge fan of Wes, by the way, just in general. I think he's a brilliant breath of fresh air. I'm not going to get into the politics of the decisions around job losses and stuff. Obviously, my heart goes out to everybody that has lost their job. It's a terrible thing to have happen to you. And I've done some things on LinkedIn and others to try and help with resources things like that. But I do think Wes has the will to make change, which I think is much needed. But I agree with you about Keir. It seems like he sort of delegated it a bit. And it's you manage the health bit over there, Wes, and, you know, I'm going to talk about whatever I'm going to talk about.
I know. I think we've all felt a bit puzzled about this. Before the election, there was a lot of talk from the Labour Party. In fact, promises were made in the manifesto about tackling the poor health of the country. Mm. And then it got downgraded almost immediately to being a cabinet committee. Mm. And that cabinet committee was then chaired by Wes, not the Prime Minister.
Mm.
And I can tell you as an insider, the moment that happens,
you're
back to blaming the health department for the health of the nation.
And interesting, because as soon as the PM takes him or herself out of that, then it's just one of many committees.
Exactly. And we can't improve the health of the nation without DEFRA being involved.
Yeah.
Without
because DEFRA is where food policy sits,
right? Food policy and also the air.
The air.
So you need transport involved. You need housing involved. I don't want to make this more complicated than it needs to be. I don't like the fact that I'm saying that the whole of government needs to work on this. It's just true.
Yeah.
And the person I weirdly envy is Ed Miliband.
Okay.
I mean, I don't agree
with him.
I think he's a bit over the top. But God, I admire his radicalism and his kitchen sink approach.
Mm.
He is absolutely throwing everything he's got at trying to bring our carbon production down.
Yeah.
I think it's over the top, but in terms of the way of running policy, that's the right approach.
Mm.
And I wish there was a bit more Ed Miliband about the way we did health.
And what happens? Is it because I'm always interested because effectively there's actually like a relatively small number of people that decide what happened in the country.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of electorate versus selectorate versus the people that actually decide things. And so why is there, for example, you've got Ed Miliband over there in environmental blazing a bit of a trail, but then in health, it's not quite the same.
So there's one, that's a big question, but I'll tell you the one thing I think is the biggest problem. We do not ultimately believe that improving the nation's health will improve the economy. In other words, it's seen through the lens of social justice, which is nice and woolly and makes me feel good, but will never, ever move the needle politically.
Mm.
If you have the Treasury believing that health is essentially a sunk cost, like defence, with no benefit to the economy, ultimately, then it doesn't care what you spend the money on. It just regards it all as a total write-off, and you're basically spending the money for political reasons. Until we solve that problem, persuading the Treasury and the Bank of England and the OBR and our political leaders that a healthier population will be a more prosperous population, we're going to be in the same doom loop.
That is a great place to stop for our second commercial break, and I want to pick that up because we need to find a way to break that because that is barking mad for me, given all of the statistics and everything we've seen. So we'll be right back with the last part of today's show with my wonderful guest today, James Bethell, former health minister, member of the House of Lords and health advocate. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena-sensitive care pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena-sensitive care pads with a skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's show, this week's Health Tech Hour, with my guest James Bethel. So James, before that we were talking about a really critical insight, which is the government, the treasury, the people with the cash, effectively,
yes,
don't think that good health creates upside. They view health as just a cost and it gets written off and it gets invested and that's what it is. But the actual, there's no, whether you do it good or bad, it doesn't create any more value for the business, for the country, which is the business.
Yeah, and the reason why they think that is they've got a good point, because we have doubled the spending on health since 1997.
Wow. Is that in real terms as well?
In real terms.
Doubled?
Yep. We're now 220. We used to be 980. We're now 220. And the health of the nation has deteriorated in that time, or at least for the bottom half.
Right.
And we've got a huge welfare bill.
And it's
getting
bigger.
From people for one reason or another,
yeah,
are saying that they're too sick to work. Now, you can make your own views on whether they are, what's going on there. But there is no way that the money that we have spent on health in the last 15 years has given a good return on investment. And we should look to our health leaders and ask them, why has that happened? Mm. Now, not unreasonably, they will say, but only 20% of a person's health is determined by the clinical interventions. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is their own behaviors in their environment. Okay, so where's the leadership on those two things? What are we doing as a country and what are our health leaders doing?
And this is why I find it confusing. And we talked about this when we were prepping for the show, didn't we? Which is spend has more than doubled.
Yep.
Health outcomes have got worse.
Yes.
But smoking has gone off a cliff, although it may have plateaued.
It's still quite high for poor people. Well, so no middle class people smoke.
So this is where we get into the details, yeah, right? Alcohol consumption amongst some demographics is at its lowest historical level probably ever.
Amongst middle class young people,
right?
Not broadly across the country.
So exactly. So this is where it starts to get a little bit more nuanced,
yes,
right? So it's not just it becomes more around how can we impact health among certain demographics.
Yes, and there are, you're right, that we have got insights on how to change people's behaviour and how to work in partnership with people, and there are little bits of improvement. But on something like activity, again, totally moving sideways. And the ambition is to lift 1 million people out of inactivity. My goodness, there are tens of millions of people who need to be lifted out.
Yeah.
So we are not doing anything like enough to try to improve the overall health of the nation. Nor will we until we genuinely believe that, like with education, health is an essential underpinning for the nation's wealth. So no one would argue that improving health education standards amongst our secondary system, our university system, improves the amount of money that we can charge for our workforce.
Yeah, no one disputes that. It's indisputable.
Our human capital, though, is also determined by health. The amount of time that people work in their life should go up. Actually, for most people, it's coming down.
Yeah.
People shouldn't retire when they're 55. They should retire when they're 65 or 75. And when I say should, I mean for the prosperity of the country and also for their own longevity, because working means that you live longer.
Yeah.
We should all be thinking about working for a lot longer. Also, the quality of work that people can do will improve if they are healthy, Their mental health is good. Their physical health is good. So for all those reasons, health is an essential underpinning for our economic and emotional prosperity. And yet the mandarins and the leading thinkers who drive policy in the country absolutely do not believe that. In fact, they think the opposite. For all the additional money that we've spent on health, actually, it seems to have made things worse because what we're doing is we're saving the lives of people who might otherwise die and keeping them alive for quite a long time, during which they claim welfare and are a burden on their communities and on the taxpayer. Now, that's a very brutal way of putting it, but that has been the lived experience, if you can put it that way, of the financial brains who make these decisions at the top of the country. They are very bitter and disappointed about all the money they've spent on health. And for you and me, Steve, who are passionate and champions for health and health policy, we need to think about what we've done.
Let's talk about, like, what are one or two, if you were to pick one or two, or dare I say three things, that if you had a magic wand, that you would do right now to try and address this specific issue?
So like, I don't think that there is a simple health policy thing.
No.
I don't think that there's like, we focused on primary care, or if only we taught how to cook in schools. I think all of those things are important. I think there are three things that we really need. One is a measurement thing, which is we need to measure outcomes, not inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone says this, but why on earth aren't we doing it? We have something called the Health Index, which is one way of doing it. We've just abandoned the funding of that by the ONS, which is a very bad sign. In other words, we're measuring waiting lists. What a nihilistic, sad way of measuring the health of the nation on how much sick people are waiting in order to have treatment or diagnostics.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so important.
Are we not tracking outcomes?
It's like measuring, with my old banger of a car, it's like measuring how many times a year I have to take it to the garage. That is not a fair measurement of whether it's a good car.
If you're viewing it like a business, footfall is interesting.
Yes.
That is an interesting,
but
good
not
to see.
Complaints.
But no, yeah, but also you do look at things like revenue and customer satisfaction and things like that at the end of the process.
Precisely. So we need to be measuring income, basically.
Yeah.
So we need to be measuring the value of our human capital.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we need some kind of political movement around this.
Mm.
We need to give politicians the dopamine fix of feeling like they've done the right thing.
Yes.
We need to have campaigns. I admire hugely, and these are micro campaigns around smartphone-free schools.
Yep.
Where
that was really
mums
successful.
And dads, it hasn't yet delivered, but they've got hundreds of thousands of mums and dads fighting for the right to control, to get phones out of schools, and ultimately to be able to control the filth that their children are seeing. I admire the kids who are fighting against junk food. I admire people who are fighting for NHS canteens to be better.
Yeah,
I admire the people who are fighting for ULEZ in order to clean up our air. In other words, we need grassroots campaigns that politicians can plug into so that they feel good about the kind of interventions that we need.
And I do think politicians, they like backing a winner, don't they?
They do.
They love a thing to associate themselves with that is a good news thing that is delivering and delivers change.
Exactly. And then thirdly, within the health system itself, we need to attribute value to early stage diagnostics and treatment.
Mm.
In other words, we do a great job with NICE of attributing value with qualities and assessments on late stage disease. So if you have an oncological drug that can give someone 3 months extra life, boy, oh boy, the statistical analysis of that is copper-bottomed and respected around the world.
Yep.
If you have something that will give people a reduced chance of getting dementia in 20 years' time, we are very poor. I just took my shingles vaccine last week.
Yep.
Why did I do that? I'm a bit early to do that. I'm not 65 is the current guidance.
Okay.
I'm 10 years off that.
Okay.
But I did it because the evidence is quite clear that it reduces dramatically my chances of getting a dementia later in life.
And when you say evidence, did you have to go find that yourself, or is that NHS approved evidence or NICE evidence?
Yeah, I kind of had to find it myself. I mean, I have access to the experts. The NHS recognized this, and they do give shingles vaccines to 65-year-olds.
Yeah.
So I'm taking it earlier than recommended.
Mm.
But I kind of think that we should be looking at doing that for more people. It's such a cheap intervention.
Yeah.
someone who gets Alzheimer's disease at 65 and lives for 10, 15 years costs their family, their community, and the state a huge amount of money.
Where?
Boy, oh boy, we save a lot of trouble if we can head a bit of that off.
How does that – there are so many of these things in health, ideas like that or concepts like that. How does this get woven together into something that a political decision can be made or a structural decision can be made about these things, you know? Because there's just thousands of these opportunities.
Yes.
Shingles, weight loss, whatever it might – you know, prostate cancer screening. There's just – there's a lot of things there that they need to, we need to figure out how to weave it together.
So I don't know if I have a complete answer for you, but climate change is a sort of example.
That's a good analogy.
So what Nick Stern did, he was the Mandarin that was appointed at the very beginning to assess what the country could do, and he predicted what would happen in 30 years' time if we did nothing, and the economic consequences for that, which were pretty grim. By the way, the economic consequences of us failing to grapple with our health are also very grim.
I can imagine
and
it might be even
children
worse.
Children are totally bankrupt if we don't turn this ship around.
Yeah.
He then put a price on a ton of carbon. Now, interestingly, he got the price slightly wrong and it had to be changed, but he put a mechanism in place.
Yeah, he put a metric.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We don't have a metric for healthy longevity.
We do.
We are not measuring that as a national asset.
It's not a value that we look at.
And therefore, all the decisions that we make in our health system are really totally subjective as to what makes us feel good right now.
Mm.
And it's all done really on waiting lists at the moment. That is the political imperative. Mm. What a tragic way of running a...
Or GP appointments.
Yeah, or GP appointments, or numbers of nurses. These are not sensible mission level objectives. So we need to break from that cul-de-sac of objectives.
Mm.
And we need to make the bracing decision to really look at a human capital value to drive the system.
And that would be like someone appointed with a kind of brief
need,
to just
we
go
need
and...
We need a Nick Stern of health, basically.
Yeah, wow.
Who could that be, do you think, Steve? Who would you recommend?
You, James, maybe.
I love that idea.
but joking aside, I mean, it does need to... That does need to happen, I think.
We should do it. Honestly, I don't see this government doing it in the next 4 years.
Oh,
so we can let it drift.
They've got a lot on their plate.
We can let it drift. But I think, Steve, you and I should set up the Stern Report for Health.
Let's do it.
And even if it's, you know, a first, you know, MVP.
Yeah.
Then let's get that
you and
up
I
on
always,
LinkedIn you know, before the end of the week.
Yeah, let's do it. No, but I'm up for it because I do feel like I always want to be part of the solution.
Yeah.
And like you... I interact with entrepreneurs all – and they're doing incredible things. Not just business entrepreneurs, but clinical entrepreneurs in system, right? They're coming up with all kinds of new ideas and innovations all the time.
Well, take your own product.
Yeah, PocDoc.
If you put a value connected with healthy longevity to your product, it would rate much more highly than spending a fortune on a surgical robot that helped remove late-stage tumors from a cancer patient, if you have stage 4 cancer, that's heartbreaking. If you have a terminal diagnosis, heartbreaking. I feel for every single person in that condition. But the hard-nosed economic realities are giving that person 6 months extra life is not nearly as valuable as giving dozens of people the chance to sidestep cardiovascular disease in 20 years' time.
I mean, I think this is the really difficult, awkward discussions that need to sort of happen.
Yes.
And that's why you need that kind of metric. It's a bit like with the, if you go back to climate change, it's like, well, yeah, people that work in coal mines are going to lose their job.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're in America where they reopen them, but there might be some other things happening over here that sort of offset that in some way, shape or form. So it's that type of discussion.
Yes.
And so like what on another topic I know that we've discussed previously is this area around prostate screening.
Yes.
So my, obviously with Chris Hoy's diagnosis recently, and a lot of these things get, when it's celebrity back, like the Davina effect in menopause.
Yeah.
Widely regarded as one of the things that got menopause from sort of not being widely discussed to being on the top and quite rightly on the top of a lot of health systems agendas. And Chris Hoy's done something similar with prostate cancer.
Yeah.
That is a very thorny issue, though, and you've got seemingly two tribes One is like, why on earth aren't we screening for this?
Yeah.
And the other tribe is saying, well, it's not economically viable.
Yeah.
For it.
So you're right. I think that is the current state of debate. That, how sad that it is in those terms, because both of them are obviously completely wrong.
Yeah.
The obvious answer, which we all know, is that it should be personalized public health.
Mm.
No way should we have mass universal screening.
No.
Those who make the arguments that that leads to too many false positives, too much use of MRIs, and is incredibly disruptive to the health system are absolutely right.
Mm.
But how did the Chris Hoy thing happen? Mm. His father died of prostate cancer.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Is that right? I didn't know that.
Absolutely high risk. He should have had a letter. The NHS should have come and knocked on his door and walked him to a prostate test when he was 40 years old.
That's nuts. I didn't know that. Isn't it heartbreaking?
So it's got to be risk stratified.
Mm.
I mean, we all have far too many things going on to be able to do all of everything all the time. What we all need to know is what our risks are. My father died of heart disease. My grandfather died of heart disease.
Mm.
That is my number one risk.
Well, so we get a lot of the people that actually go and you either engage with PocDoc through one of our NHS screenings or go and purchase the test at Boots or Superdrug or Well or from our website. The number one piece of feedback we get is that normally family member, aunt, uncle, mother, brother, father had heart issues and wanted to get checked.
Yeah. And I have a Vox Max of nearly 40.
Yeah.
And yet I have a blood pressure of 150. Wow. Why is that? My genetics are not great for heart.
Mm.
So I have a personal struggle on that. And that's what I have to focus on. So by comparison, worrying about prostate cancer is not my personal priority.
Mm.
And my PSA is very low anyway.
Mm.
So sure, I'm going to keep an eye on it. But I'm not going to be stressing the health system trying to worry about prostate cancer. I'm going to stress about my heart disease. And everyone should have their own sense of what their risks are and to try to lead lifestyles and a medical strategy to deliver that.
Mm.
That's the kind of thing that you would do for your pension, for your children's education, for the security of your home.
Mm.
We're all sophisticated individuals. We can deal with complexity, but we have infantilized our population and we have made it incredibly difficult for them to make those kinds of choices.
I think that's the kind of turnaround. The prostate one's really tricky, right? Because it's a really tricky one. And I think it highlights something, which is even if you were to go to your GP,
yes,
as a 40-something or a 50-something, maybe, yeah, I'm not quite sure when the age kicks in, but let's say you were slightly under
what? I think it's 40, yeah.
40. And then you said, oh, I'm concerned and I'd like to get a PSA test.
Yeah.
I've had this. And they said, no, you don't need one.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay. But I was trying to take control of my health and be proactive. And now I feel a bit discombobulated because you said, like, I kind of know I want one, but you said I can't get one. So what happens now?
It's the wrong way around. What we have done is the reverse of common sense. We have socialized acute care, which is frankly something that you could give to an insurance company to do because it's all predictable. And we have privatized public health.
Mm.
We're saying to people, if you want a PSA, you have to go to Holland and Barrett and buy one.
Yeah.
It's kind of the wrong way around.
Or like you with your vaccine, right? You went private.
Yeah, I had to pay £480 for my shingles vaccine. Now, that's maybe the clinical director and the vaccine committee at the NHS have got a point. Maybe the evidence isn't there for me to be taking it early. I don't mind a little bit of unilateral sort of behavior on my part, but it's become very common that there are large parts of early stage intervention the NHS just isn't supporting individuals.
It's the same thing in
giving
healthy
them
hearts.
The data, and this question of data is fundamental. The NHS app is an improvement, but it's still incredibly difficult even to access your own data or to share it.
Yeah.
And you're just throwing up barriers to prevent people from leading healthy lives.
Right. We've got the last couple of minutes of the show. So let's end on a positive note. Give us one piece of green shoots. What do you, in these dark moments where you feel like it's really bleak, what do you remind yourself about?
Well, there are two things. I think one is just the science. I mean, every single day we're seeing the fruits of investment in data, in vaccines, in all manner of early stage diagnostics and treatment bear fruit.
Mm.
And I am very thankful to the visionaries who have been seeding this area for a long, long time. I mean, it all happened way before I became minister. And boy, oh, and Britain is a leader in this, mm-hmm. and we are contributing globally. So I think that the pull for change will be the efficacy of the interventions. Mm. And it's not happening quickly enough, but people are going to see, like they have done with the GLPs, that they work and will therefore chase them because they make a difference. So that is very exciting. I think also our people, the voters, patients, taxpayers, are becoming what they say activated with the thought that they do need to lead healthier lives. And that is happening too slowly. And it's tilted very much to middle class people, to health hackers and the worried well, as they used to be called. But I am a champion for the worried well. I want the whole country to become the worried well. Not because I want them to put an unbearable strain on the NHS and to keep troubling their GPs with waste of time questions, but because I want them to be concerned that they're making the right steps to lead a healthy life.
I think that's a perfect place to end the show. James, thank you very much for coming on
thank
the show.
Thank you, Steve. I love being here.
And if people wanted to hear more about you talking, where do they go?
Well,
you've got some different channels.
I have my own LinkedIn, so you can have a look at me there. And I'm a social media addict like too many of us. And I don't know if you can avoid me.
Well, great. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show.
Fantastic.